Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, marking the feast of St. Anselm. But first, the writings of Benedict XVI. Always a journey. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. On Monday, 16th of April, Benedict XVI turned 85. And on the 19th of April, he marked the 7th anniversary of his election as successor of Peter. 7 years then, during which he's visited 23 countries and been on 26 more local visits in Italy, as well as held 4 synods of bishops within Vatican walls. Years during which this professor turned pope has gone on writing. Encyclicals, of course, 3 of them. From the most recent, Caritas in Veritate, or Charity in Truth, of June 2009, to Spe Salvi, or Saved in Hope, of November 2007. And the first of these documents, Deus Caritas Est, God is Love, of December 2005, the very first year of his pontificate. But also books. The 2 volumes on Jesus of Nazareth, and a third by the title of Light of the World, taken from a series of interviews in which he tackles some of the issues facing today's society. But why don't we listen to an editorial by the papal spokesman Jesuit Father Federico Lombardi to mark the 2 anniversaries, his birthday and the 7th of his election, in a translation of his comments read for us by Sean Patrick Lovett, naturally referring to Pope Benedict.
Above all, we've learned from the coherence and consistency of his teaching that the priority of his service to the Church and to humanity is to guide lives to God, to the God who is made known by Jesus Christ, that faith and reason help one another in seeking the truth and respond to the expectations and demands of each one of us and humanity as a whole, that the marginalization of God and relativism are serious dangers of our time. We're truly grateful for all of this, and we journey along with him, towards the World Meeting of Families and his trip to the Middle East, towards the Synod on the New Evangelization and the Year of the Faith. In the hands of God, serving God, and the Church of God.
Well, having listened to the papal spokesman's words there, I'd now like you to join the Archbishop of Liverpool, Patrick Kelly, who was kind enough to sit down with me in our studios here and share with me some thoughts relating precisely to the writings of Benedict XVI, in which he remarks how these writings are wondrously simple but always a journey. Why don't you stay tuned? Benedict XVI is very clear about what he believes in. Would you say that's a hallmark of his pontificate?
It is. Some of them said it's a double quality, I think. And I've been privileged to meet him over the years before he was Pope. I used to come every year with Cardinal Murphy O'Connor. We used to come once a year as President and Vice President of our conference. So I've met him a lot over the years. And I think somebody put it beautifully, and they said he is serene in his faith and in his theology, which means that it doesn't matter what question he issues, he never starts fearful about where it may lead. I would say that the 2 beautiful books, Jesus of Nazareth, the spirit, for example, in which he ends the dialogue with the rabbi, and the rabbi remains, as he says, with the first Israel, leaves without rancour, which is a sign of the power of reconciling love. That is very special, to be able to have a dialogue which doesn't end in total agreement, parting, if you like, of certain level, but without rancour, and that's a sign of reconciling love. That is a very precious gift we've been given, and I'm a member of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, and I think that serenity does prepare the ground for the very challenging dialogues which we are going to need, not least with the Muslim world. But we do it from the serenity of the confidence, not only I know what the Church teaches, but the serenity of saying I've never run away from a question about the truth, who is the Lord.
Is it too strong a statement then to say that he's a man without doubts?
I think doubt is a very strange word, because doubt means that I'm never going to face a question which I've never thought of. And I think one security is the security of saying I've got all the answers. The second is I've got asked all the questions. The third, the real one, is I've never run away from a question. Therefore, I need never fear a new question, because all the ones that have come my way, I've not stifled them, I've not run away from them, I've wrestled with them until I find the light. And I think that there's very much the feel of Cardinal Newman, whom, of course, the Holy Father beatified. The feeling Cardinal Newman's writings, I think, is whenever you wrestle with a question to the end, you never find you're at the end with darkness. You may still be aware there's a journey ahead, but it's still a light which is going to lead me on, that famous line of Cardinal Newman, "Lead, kindly light, lead thou me on the distant scene I do not ask to see." I think that's the spirit.
Here at the radio, we read a lot of his homilies and speeches, yes. Most of them. And the feeling is that very often the media at large pick up on what they consider the newsworthy stories, whereas if you actually look at his speeches or his homilies, there's a lot of hidden information there.
Beautiful. I think, in a way, one of the challenges of our time, and we're addressing it, it was interesting how, in the name of the Pontifical Council, I went to a meeting in Doha, which was about the role of the new media in the Arab Spring, however we wish to call it. And it became a much broader issue about the role of the modern media. It tends to be soundbites. And you cannot use soundbites for the big issues. And the phrase I always dread is the word relevant. Relevant, if we're not very careful, means I will only attend to that which immediately concerns me here and now. That's the road to death. That's the road to absolute time. I always think of Dickens' description of Scrooge, solitary and self-contained as an oyster. If I define that which I will read or watch or listen to by whether it's relevant for me here and now, that's disaster. And it's rather like, I think, some of the debates we've had about the New English Missal. People have said the sentences are long. I've realised if we learn to pray them, well, real prayer cannot be a soundbite. It must introduce you, even if it's only for the brief set length of a prayer, into a journey, not just present you with hard, cold analysis, but it must always have an openness to it. And the longer sentences, it's interesting how in English we use the word a period. The old word for a sentence was a period. It's got time to it. It doesn't just be one word. And I think the writings and the homilies of the Holy Father, they are wondrously simple, but they're always a journey.
Right from the start?
Yes.
Right from the start, has this image of the desert, right?
That's not the opening homily.
Extraordinary.
And also the simplicity of imagery, looking at the desert, and they said that, which I've never heard anything, if you like, so anthropomorphic about the Trinity. The Son of God leapt to his feet.
In the first?
The first homily. And you think, that's a beautiful image. You've got the image of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit sitting, coming to him home. The Son says, "Father, I'm off," and leaps to his feet. It's a beautiful image, and it's so daring.
Something that people can do when they really know their subject.
Exactly.
But at this point, why don't we listen to a passage from the Pope's homily on that occasion that's recorded was the 24th of April 2005, and the place was St Peter's Square. We can listen to the Pope's voice in Italian and then have a translation in English.
L'umanità, noi tutti, è la pecora smarrita che nel deserto non trova più la strada.
The human race, every one of us, is the sheep lost in the desert, which no longer knows the way. The Son of God will not let this happen. He cannot abandon humanity in so wretched a condition. He leaps to his feet and abandons the glory of heaven in order to go in search of the sheep and pursue it all the way to the cross.
Balza in piedi, abbandona la gloria del cielo per ritrovare la pecorella e inseguirla fin sulla croce.
He takes it upon his shoulders and carries our humanity. He carries all of us. He is the good shepherd who lays down his life for the sheep.
Egli è il buon pastore che offre la sua vita per le pecore.
Having mentioned this passage, I'd now like to move on to a Pope's pastoral visit to Turin in May of 2010, an occasion in which he venerated the Holy Shroud and gave a meditation. But I'll let you pinpoint the exact passage.
The negative and positive, the mystery that this shroud, which what we see is the result of photographing a negative. And the shroud is a negative in one level, and yet it shines with the positive.
Che la Sacra Sindone si comporta come un documento fotografico dotato di un positivo e di un negativo.
The Holy Shroud acts as a photographic document with both a positive and a negative. And in fact, this is really how it is. The darkest mystery of faith is at the same time the most luminous sign of a never-ending hope.
Nello stesso tempo il segno più luminoso di una speranza che non ha confini.
It's rather like the person of culture when the Synod on the Holy Land, when we had the Verdi Requiem in the audience hall, and he spoke about the Verdi Requiem at the end. Many of us said, well, wouldn't it be good if he played the whole thing again, now that we know what it's about?
He has great understanding of music.
Great understanding. And certainly, I mean, this Verdi in Easter week, the gospel of the catch of fishes of our Lord risen from the dead, 153 big fish, and the net was not broken. And I remember his homily on the day of the receiving the pallium, when he said, but sadly, the net is broken now.
It was at the end of that homily, and I have the translation of the text in Italian here, in which, as you just mentioned, he says, and the account of the 153 large fish ends with the joyful statement, although there were so many, the net was not torn. Alas, beloved Lord, with sorrow we must now acknowledge that it has been torn, but no, we must not be sad. I thought it was worth reading those precise words.
And that's how he described the fractured nature of Christians. But we will not be sad. The Lord will gather us. And to be able to mention a great sadness and then in the same breath say, but we will not be sad, must lift people up.
Meanwhile, Saturday, 21st of April, marks the feast of St. Anselm. St. Anselm of Canterbury, of Aosta, or of Bec? To answer that question, we join Dom Henry O'Shea, secretary to the Abbot Primate of the Benedictine Confederation, Notker Wolf, and a Benedictine himself, of course. Dom Henry O'Shea. You just told me that by training you were a historian.
Yes.
I can ask you the first question. I'm a little confused. St. Anselm was a Benedictine monk.
Yes.
Considered to be an Italian.
Yes.
Monk, medieval philosopher and theologian who was born in Aosta, which then was within the boundaries of the Kingdom of Burgundy. Yet I think he's best known to the English-speaking world as St. Anselm of Canterbury. There's a bit of a leap there. From Aosta to Canterbury. What did he do? Go hopping around all the various monasteries in Europe?
Yes. Well, I think the first thing we've got to be aware of is that modern boundaries, of course, are relatively recent. The Burgundy you're talking about was much bigger than the Burgundy that we would know today.
It was
a kingdom. In its own right, and very important, in fact. One of the main titles, for example, of the Habsburgs later on was actually Duke of Burgundy. And it still features in the coats of arms, if you're interested in those things. But the important thing is that you're talking about somebody who While being very careful not to transfer modern categories of European, etc., etc., at the same time, it is true that at that stage there was a fairly cosmopolitan society. That's the first thing. The second thing, of course, about Anselm is that one of the main reasons he left home was because of an unsatisfactory relationship with his father.
He came from an aristocratic family.
His father clearly wasn't terribly keen on his joining the monastery, which he wanted to do at the age of 15. So he went then to Normandy. Now, I suppose, again, transferring modern ideas to those days, that was one of the places where careers were being made at the time. They were themselves, Normandy, as the name would suggest, were themselves, as it were, two or three centuries on from their own invasion, and we're now talking about the time running up to the Norman invasion of England.
Anselm was born in 1033.
1033, exactly. So, 30 years before.
30 years before 1066.
And all that, yes. And so I think, of course, the main attraction seems to have been that Lanfranc, who also came from that part of Burgundy, was the prior of Bec at the time, a monastery which in recent times has come to exist again. I think if we're to believe what we're told by his Lives of Anselm, etc., he was also attracted by the intellectual status of Lanfranc. It's normal today to think of Benedictines as learned. That, in fact, really comes from a development in the 17th century rather than before that. But nevertheless, it's true in this case that Bec was the centre of learning, particularly was the centre of what we might call the revival of learning after the so-called Dark Ages, which were never as dark as we were led to believe. But nevertheless,
the time of St. Bede and the Venerable.
Well, that was slightly earlier, yes, of course. And Anselm, I suppose, if he was thinking historically, though we don't know whether he did or not.
He wrote about Bede, didn't he?
Yes, he did, and he would probably have seen himself then in that tradition of monastic learning, which is why, of course, he's so interesting for many Benedictines today as well. It's very interesting for me, coming as I do from Ireland. I don't normally think of St. Anselm primarily as Anselm of Canterbury at all. I think of him primarily as Anselm of Bec, not of Aosta, not of Canterbury, but of Bec. Because if you were to take Anselm as a model, one of the most interesting things for us is his time as prior of Bec, where he really started what was in effect, though not a name, a university. It's probably better to use the German word Hochschule.
What do you mean?
Centre of learning, high school, basically.
You mentioned his appeal to you today as a monk, I imagine, as a Benedictine monk, Dom Henry. But what is his appeal, do you think, to the rest of the world, the Catholic world, the Anglicans and the Lutherans as well?
I think probably the most important thing is the combination of genuine sanctity with intellectual rigour and curiosity, because for many people there's a great tendency, not just today but in previous centuries as well, to imagine that to embrace the religious life is also to embrace a certain form of brain death, and that is not at all true. And the great attraction of Anselm is that he combines a very, very strong faith with strong sense of intellectual inquiry and also a strong sense of intellectual rigour. He wrote, of course, highly interesting things, and the questions he talked about both in theology and in philosophy are absolutely fascinating for us today. It doesn't necessarily mean that we automatically agree with everything he said, because in many ways the debate has moved on, as it were. But the very fact that the debate itself should have taken place at all is fascinating. And the issues he discussed are still issues for today. The existence of God, the role of individual faith, the appropriation of the teaching of the Church, the appropriation of the teaching of the Bible, etc. Those are all as acute issues today as they were 1,000 years ago.
His symbol in hagiography, however you pronounce that word, is the ship.
Yes.
It represents the spiritual independence of the church, no?
Not just that. I'm very interested in heraldry. though interestingly, his coat of arms is not the ship, but it's used as his attribute as a saint. What it really is the idea of set out into the deep. Set out into the deep for various things. Set out into the deep as a pastor, as a fisherman, but also set out into the deep of the possible dangers of exploration and inquiry. That's also terribly important. So it's a very happy symbol, which I would have no difficulty in identifying.
Yet he was caught between being a contemplative monk and a savvy politician, in a sense, wasn't he?
Of course, but that was inevitable in those times, given the political, we use the word now, position of the Archbishop of Canterbury, or even an Abbot of Bec. Because remember, of course, that these people were also important feudal lords. And as feudal lords, of course, that was the origin of the dispute then between the Pope and the Emperor, between the King and the Archbishop, about the precise role of both. The King as the temporal lord who depended on the support of his feudal lords in battle, for example, an Archbishop had to provide the service of so many knights, etc. Or if he couldn't do that, he had to provide money. So inevitably, an Archbishop, a prelate of any kind, of any importance, would be caught up in the political circumstances of the day. And of course, remember, at this time you're also dealing in the period immediately during and after the Gregorian reforms. This whole question, this reassertion of the, or probably assertion is a better word than reassertion, of the temporal as well as the spiritual power of the papacy and the church generally. What you were really at a period where we're working out what in subsequent centuries was to become the current models both of the political society and of the ecclesiastical society. We tend, of course, today to make this absolute distinction between church and state. That's a relatively modern development, of which this, of course, is the beginning. There are other civilizations and other cultures that just don't have that concept, even today.
Even the fact of St. Anselm writing to people like kings and queens, like Matilda of England. That gives you the sense of the role of the church in society. It transpires in Pius X's encyclical Communium Rerum, which was published to mark eight centuries since Anselm's death. It seems incredible that a pope would write an encyclical on a figure like Anselm today. I mean, you wouldn't think of Benedict today writing an encyclical on St. Anselm, would you?
Probably not an encyclical, but he certainly wrote a letter recently, because he's a very important person for the present Holy Father, precisely because he emphasised, St. Anselm, that is, emphasised the importance of reason, the importance of intelligence, the importance of intelligent inquiry, the possibility of uniting that with faith. The important thing, of course, for Anselm, as it is also for the present Holy Father, we start off in a context of faith, and all our theologizing, all our philosophizing is done in that context of faith. It doesn't mean, of course, that we don't apply the necessarily rigorous intellectual standards. Of course, we have to do that. But it's not at all unusual. Also, of course, I don't know how encyclicals come to be, but certainly at the time the Benedictines were in the course of a great revival at the beginning of the 20th century, and Pius X was a great supporter of, for example, the College of Sant'Anselmo in Rome, which was not called Sant'Anselmo just for nothing. It was also, of course, because we were Benedictines, Anselm was a Benedictine, but also because the College of Sant'Anselmo had already been established in the 17th century, St. Anselm being the great model theologian, intellectual saint, etc. The title was transferred then at the end of the 19th century to this new Benedictine confederation, which had been set up by Pope Leo XIII. To try to unify the Benedictines, he wasn't totally successful in that, but what he was very successful in was establishing the College of St. Anselmo as a centre of theology, philosophy, intellectual inquiry and training for Benedictines. And I think they may have had something to do in encouraging Pope Pius X to write his encyclical, because, of course, he talks about all of that, the importance of faith, reason.
What do you think is the Benedictine hallmark of St. Anselm, at a personal level?
Well, for us, certainly his approach to the scriptures, for example, that's still very much in the monastic, what we now regard as the monastic tradition. There's been a huge amount of work done, particularly in the last 100 years, on the monastic use of the scriptures as a source of theology. It is also true that Anselm has already started to move from a purely scripture-based theology to his call, for example, the first of the scholastics. Now, I don't know how accurate that is as a designation. But for us Benedictines, at least for this particular Benedictine, the exciting thing is that he manages to preserve a dependence on the traditional sources of revelation, the scriptures, traditional both as a source of theology but also as a source of personal meditation, personal holiness, and at the same time starts what we would regard as a very modern intellectual appropriation of those sources as well. And that is, for me, and that's why, of course, we have him as our patron in Sant Anselmo, not just in Sant Anselmo. And then we use, it's fashionable, of course, to use certain cliches, for example, faith seeking understanding, etc., etc. But the fact that they're cliches doesn't mean that they're not true. And I certainly find that, because it's an enormous challenge all the time. As I was saying earlier on, joining the monastery does not bring with it brain death. And St. Benedict speaks, for example, in the Rule about expansion of the heart. And I think that's a hugely important concept, the heart seen as the whole person, not just an emotional thing, but also an intellectual thing. That if we think in terms of an expanding context all the time, we've got an expanding context of inquiry, an expanding context of love, expanding context of prayer. All these things are contained in that, and that is what I would see. Now, it could be, it's possible that I may be reading into St. Anselm. We always tend to interpret people in the light of our own exigencies. But I think at the same time, it's true that he can be taken as a model for these things. I think we sometimes today fall into the trap of thinking that saints must necessarily be nice people. Remember again, of course, one is a saint because of the triumph of grace in one, not because of one's own activities or one's own personality necessarily. So for that reason, when you were asking earlier on there about how you can have a savvy politician and a monk and contemplative at the same time, there may be certain presenting contradictions, but at the same time, if you make allowance for the operation, for the economy of grace in each individual, it's possible to combine these things. I don't know whether St. Anselm was a nice person. He certainly seems to be a holy person.
Thanks there go to Benedictine, Dom Henry O'Shea, currently Secretary General to the Abbot Primate of the Benedictine Confederation, and who's originally from the monastery of Glenstall Abbey in Ireland. And that brings me up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.